the title is meant to indicate that metaphysics is a discipline to be, in my view, and this is all my view, you're not getting any view from nowhere, you're getting my view from of what metaphysics is and should be like. It isn't enough like it is. And one of the things I'm going to be emphasising and recommending is that metaphysicians should get out more. And that means that, first of all, they should get out of their armchairs, and secondly, they should get out of their discipline and talk to other people in other disciplines. Now, whether they just do this for their own personal edification or whether they do it for the good of the discipline is something I'll leave it to you to judge. But my own view is that it's good for their discipline and not only for their discipline of metaphysics. And I'm hoping that this is at least mildly surprising to people who think about metaphysics, which not everyone does, on the grounds that metaphysics is usually held up as being the most abstract and reality-averse part of philosophy. So I'm hoping to convince you, or at least make it plausible, that it shouldn't be like this and it doesn't have to be like this. So my motto comes from the greatest metaphysician of the 20th century, Whitehead, and like everything else that I quote from Whitehead, it's quite hard to find little chunks that are worth quoting in amongst the verbiage of process and reality, but this comes from fairly early in process and reality, and it's the systematization of knowledge cannot be conducted in watertight compartments, and I subscribe wholly to that motto. So here is what I'm going to talk about. So firstly, I'm going to talk about ontology and systematics. This is going to set the scene. Then I'm going to talk about formal concepts, two different kinds of formal concepts. Then about the relationships between metaphysics and the sciences. The standard ways in which metaphysics interacts and has interacted with the special sciences are very well known and well travelled, and I'll just skate over those because they're not going to be my primary concern. I'm going to talk about ways less travelled. This is metaphysics is applied to things you might not think it was sensibly applied to, and you might still think that at the end of the talk, but to some extent I've had fun applying it to various odd things. I will then talk a little bit about the difference between ontology and ontologies, and how ontologies are working in applications and what their relationship is to ontology, the philosophical discipline. And then I'll finish with some methodological morals. So I've called the first part ontology and systematics. You could call it first and second philosophy. Ontology is the name developed in the 16th century by a German called, I think, Lorbach, and it was made a little more accessible by another German called Göckel, whose Latin name is slightly more harmonious, Göcklenius, but it was made popular by Christian Wolff in his book Metaphysica Generalis Sive Ontologia of 1729. Wolff developed in his Latin system. He wrote two systems of philosophy, one in Latin and one in German, and he used the second one to coin German philosophical terminology for the Latin terms in the first. He coined this term ontology for what Aristotle had called the science of being qua being, which comes up in Book Gamma, beginning of Book Gamma of the Metaphysics of Aristotle, then not so called, of course. The term is a librarian's term from the first century AD. Aristotle called it simply wisdom or first philosophy. And Aristotle says the science of being qua being studies all things and the things that pertain to them, and it does not cut off parts of the being, like of being, like other sciences do, like physics or biology or politics. And that's the that's what I mean when I talk about the parts of being. I mean those other sciences that deal with different specific subparts of the total of all there is. First philosophy or ontology is the sort of thing that Aristotle was beginning to develop in the metaphysics, and which went on to become called general metaphysics or ontology by Wolff. And that deals with those concepts and theories which apply across the board. I call them go-anywhere concepts. These are the concepts that apply to any realm of being whatsoever. Now, unlike Aristotle, Wolff didn't just think that metaphysics was confined to ontology. He also thought that there were a series of slightly less general metaphysical disciplines. He called them special metaphysicses. There were three of them. There was rational cosmology, rational psychology, and rational theology. And these dealt with the three realms of being, according to Wolff, namely the material, the mental, and the divine. So he had general metaphysics, which was ontology, which applied to everything. These were concepts and theories which went anywhere and were valid everywhere. And then there were the three more specialized, but still rational and rationalist metaphysical disciplines of the material, the mental, and the divine. Now, that idea was taken up and slightly modified at the beginning of the 20th century by Edmund Husserl, not normally a name one associates with metaphysics, but I think mainly because, like lots of people at that time, he shunned use of the term. It was still rather infradig to call it metaphysics in 1900 when Husserl was publishing this stuff. And Husserl makes a distinction from about 1900 on through the rest of his career between what he calls formal ontology on the one hand and what he sometimes calls material ontologies, but more frequently calls regional ontologies. And these regional ontologies correspond to the special metaphysics of Wolff, except that Husserl has a different division. So he does have a division into the natural ontology, the ontology of the natural world, the ontology of the mental world, which for Husserl, the phenomenologist, was fairly independent of the natural world. He also has the divine, but he also has other areas such as culture and history. So Husserl has several regional ontologies, which you might be interested in looking at the essential concepts applicable in those areas. But he also has formal ontology, which is his name for what he originally called the general theory of the object as such. And he stopped using that term because he thought he'd been plagiarized by Meinong in Meinong's theory of objects. It was quite false. In fact, Meinong had come up with his notion of theory of objects independently of Husserl. They both had the same teacher, but they developed the idea independently of one another. But Husserl was so jealous of anybody getting close to his ideas that he wrongly accused Meinong of plagiarism, and they then broke off relations. It was rather a sad story. They were both rather touchy characters. And so Husserl renamed the general theory of objects as such formal ontology. So he went back to Wolff's older term. And I just want to mention that for Husserl, formal ontology contrasts not only with the various regional ontologies, but also with formal logic. So for Husserl, formal logic and formal ontology, although they are connected, he talks about them being two sides of formal disciplines, nevertheless, they are distinct disciplines. So formal logic is about truths and propositions and representations, whereas formal ontology is about things and properties and worlds and states of affairs and those sorts of things. And there is a correlation between them in Husserl, which comes out probably most clearly in his 1929 work, Formal and Transcendental Logic, but which I'm not going to go into. The main thing to keep in mind is that there is this general metaphysical discipline, formal ontology, on the one hand, and various applications of it at the next level of specialization. The problem with Wolff's and Husserl's way of doing it is that their divisions into different special metaphysics are all controversial. It depends on taking up specific metaphysical positions, for instance, being a dualist, as both of them were, or believing in God, as both of them did. So rather than be hostage to a particular division of the next level, if you like, according to what you think are the next fundamental divisions of kinds of things, whether you are a a one category ontologist or a naturalist or a dualist or whatever you are. I prefer to call the collection of metaphysical theories which deal with specific areas or more specific areas than general ontology, I just call that systematics, and that's a name borrowed from biology. In biology, systematics is the study of the diversity of all forms of life. It's a relatively ill-defined area of biology, but it does connect up with taxonomy in a very nice way. And leads to discussions of categories and other things which are very germane to metaphysical discussion. The most recent philosopher of the recent past who has made a similar division between general and special metaphysics in the Wolffian, Husserlian manner is the American philosopher D.C. Williams, possibly the most wrongly underrated philosopher of the 20th century, but I think he's gradually acquiring a greater prestige, and more people are coming to hear about him. He was an exact contemporary of Quine's at Harvard, and Quine was rushing around getting all the limelight, and Williams was quietly working away, building a metaphysical system. And those of you who like the kind of ontology of properties that I like, namely trope theory, will know that D.C. Williams was the guy who introduced the word trope into metaphysical discussion, probably on the suggestion of George Santayana, mainly because the word was so unused in philosophy, so he thought he could steal it from elsewhere. And Williams makes a distinction, later repeated by Keith Campbell in his nice little introductory book on metaphysics, between analytic ontology on the one hand, which is the sort of thing you take from analytic philosophy in general, and what he calls speculative cosmology. And it's clear that there's a bit of Russell and a bit of Whitehead in this, but there's also a bit of Husserl, and it's no accident that D.C. Williams was a careful and avid reader of Husserl's logical investigations. So that's where I'm coming from. Now, what I'm going to talk about is how to do systematics. I'm not going to talk about how to do ontology or what kind of ontology I think is the right thing to do. That's the thing I did one of the times I was here previously a year or two ago. I'm happy to talk about it at excessive length any other time, but now I'm going to talk about how to do systematics and where to do systematics, and that's why I'm talking about reaching out from analytic ontology or formal ontology to the various parts of being. To do that, first of all, however, I want to make this distinction between two different kinds of formal concepts. As I mentioned, Husserl makes a distinction between formal ontology and formal logic. And the distinction I'm going to make is closely similar to that. It's not between two disciplines, but between two different kinds of what Wittgenstein calls formal concepts. Now, Wittgenstein is a very bad example to use in metaphysics because he held to the position that metaphysics and logic, he wouldn't use the word metaphysics, but how the world is and or how the world can be and how language can, through logic, represent the world, just line up in a perfectly harmonious way. I call it Wittgenstein's pre-established harmony. And you can see it going from the notes in logic right through to the end of his life. But in the Tractatus, it takes particularly logical form. This is not so dissimilar from Husserl, except that Husserl is firstly less crisp than Wittgenstein, and secondly, he is a little more equivocal on the relationships between formal ontology and formal logic, but he does think that they are two distinct things, whereas I think in Wittgenstein's case, the possibility of their distinctness does not arise. Among those concepts which are applicable in ontology, some of them try or purport to divide being at its joints, as Plato said. We're trying, like a good butcher, to divide things at their joints and not to smash things up halfway across. In other words, we want to get at the fundamental distinctions and differences and chasms in the world, and we want to do that with concepts which whose differences correspond to those distinctions. So those are, at the highest level, those are the ontological formal concepts which are supposed to divide reality at its joints. And I'll just give you a couple of examples from the history of philosophy. I'm not going to endorse them, but I'm just going to give you some examples of those. And those are what correspond to Kant's categories, historically speaking. For Kant, the categories are the highest genera of beings. There is no genus of beings as such for Aristotle. There is no such thing as a theory of objects in general for Aristotle, because he thinks that you can't have such a thing. But the term category designates, among other things in Aristotle, those largest classes of things than which there is nothing more general. So things like substances, qualities, places, and so on, from the standard list of categories of Aristotle. They count as, those concepts corresponding to those count as concepts which divide reality at their joints, and they do so by picking out the differences between substances, qualities, quantities, and so on and so on. So a good formal ontology should be attempting to come up with concepts which divide reality at her own joints. However we do this, I mean, the question of method is a horrendously complicated one, and I'll come back to it at the end. Now, I contrast that notion of categories and what the job of metaphysical investigation is, the Aristotelian or realist concept, with the Kantian concept of what you should do in metaphysics. Kant thinks that you cannot get at reality as it is in itself. Therefore, the best you can do in metaphysics is to get at reality as it can and must be known by us. This is metaphysics within the realms of possible knowledge. It's an epistemologically constrained metaphysics. And the categories for Kant are not concepts that divide nature at its own joints. They are concepts which we are perforce constrained to use in order to have knowledge at all. That is their status. Whatever the particular case to be made for or against particular examples in Kant's scheme of categories, I'm not going to talk about those. But the point is that there is a difference in status between Aristotelian categories, which go out to try and find the joints in nature and try and correspond to those, and Kant's categories, which go out to show the fundamental structures of thought, which enable us to have knowledge at all. And this knowledge, of course, is of the phenomena behind which there are things we don't know anything about, but which are structured by the forms of intuition and the understanding. So Kant's way of dealing with categories to say these are what we need in order to be able to have knowledge, whereas Aristotle's more naive, realist point of view is, look, we need these categories in order to be able to talk about how the world is in itself. So there is a distinction then between concepts which at least try to divide nature of its joints, I call those ontic concepts, and concepts that we need in order to be able to deal with reality and to have knowledge, but which don't correspond to anything in the world. Probably the easiest example to pick is negation. Most people, with the exception of Russell in his riot-provoking lecture in Harvard in 1914, do not think that there is anything in the world which corresponds to negation. I know Sartre plays around with it in some Parisian cafe, but we don't need to take that really seriously. There is no negation in nature. So if you take that as an example, then you generalize it from negation to the other logical constants, you arrive at what Wittgenstein called his fundamental thought. The logical constants do not represent. There is nothing that they stand for. Conjunction, negation, the quantifiers, and so on, do not stand for things. Nevertheless, we would be hamstrung without those concepts. All we could do would be to utter atomic sentences. And sometimes we'd be right in so doing, and sometimes we would be wrong in so doing, but we wouldn't be able to sum up how the world is in neat ways, and we wouldn't be able to overcome the problems of ignorance. So we need the logical concepts and quite a few others, and I call those auxiliary concepts because they help us to cope with reality and how we can have knowledge of it without necessarily having it from a God's eye view. God doesn't need logic. God just knows all the facts, and they're all atomic facts. So God just knows all the individuals and doesn't need to say things like or there exists or not. It's not necessary. Of course, God knows what they mean, but looks down on them as being, well, that's what finite beings need because they are limited in various ways. Those are the auxiliary concepts that we need. Now, unlike Aristotle, I don't think that all our concepts and the most general ones, the categories, are ontic. And unlike ontic, and unlike Kant, I don't think that they are all auxiliary. I think we have some of one sort and some of the other. So here are some examples. Traditional ontic concepts are substance, accident, relation, kind, trope, state of affairs, universal, abstract object. You can recognize the beginnings of a metaphysics textbook there. These are concepts which you will find in any metaphysics book. My own view is that that doesn't quite go deeply enough, and I've talked about that here, and I think we should burrow beneath those concepts and find what I call the formal factors which differentiate them into the different concepts that they are, and actually generate a much wider palette of categories than those, which are things like identity and difference, inclusion, singular and general, cardinal number, proportion, mereological concepts, concepts to do with location in space and time and elsewhere, dependence and determination. So those are some concepts that I think that we need in order to articulate the system of categories that we would use in our ontology, in our description of how the world is. And among the auxiliary concepts, again, just picking these out of the tradition, things that don't stand for any objects or don't stand for any things, we've got Wittgenstein's logical constants, but also we have existence, which is not a predicate. It doesn't stand for anything. And unlike Kant, I don't think, or Frege, I don't think it stands for a second level concept. I don't think it stands. It is a concept, but it doesn't stand for anything at all. And I also controversially think that the notions of predicate, proposition, truth, value, and modality are auxiliary and not ontic concepts. So I am not, for instance, a modal realist, because I think that that's an auxiliary concept. That will get me into hot water, but I'm going to skip on very quickly. Actually, I'm skating over thin ice. Now, when metaphysics interacts with the sciences, which it does from time to time, depending on the metaphysician and all the scientists involved, then there are certain places in which this interaction is and has been intensive and has given rise to controversies and issues, some of them well known, some of them well on the way to being solved, others not on the way to being solved. So examples of general nature where metaphysics has interacted with science are questions about the status of laws of nature. We have one of the foremost exponents of this difficult area with us today, Alexander, and also areas such as the theory of categories, Kategorienlehre. Does that correspond to things in the world, or is it just a series of things that we are constrained to use in our language or in our logic? In the nature of taxonomy, for instance, in the empirical sciences or elsewhere. Those are general issues. In physics, for example, we have worries about the nature and or existence of space-time or space-time. We have interesting questions about relativity, special and general. We have worries about quantum theory, the so-called collapse of the wave function and what to do about it or how to avoid it. Or even worse, what happens when you go into quantum field theory and realize you can't count particles and there's no fact of the matter as to how many electrons there are in a certain place. And to bring up something that I am at least entangled with through my connections with Corpus Christi, the entanglement problem. What kind of things are going on when things are entangled one with another? Can an object which is as minute in energy as a single electron spread itself across the width of a whole galaxy? The answer seems to be yes. Then in mathematics, the metaphysics of mathematics has been a subject of hot debate since the 19th century, and although it's occasionally gone off the boil, it keeps coming back and keeps getting disputed. So we have basically the question, the dispute between Platonists and anti-Platonists about the nature of mathematical objects, comma, if any. So you have Platonists like Frege and Russell on the one hand, and Gödel, versus anti-Platonists of various kinds, whether intuitionistic, like Brouwer and Dummett, or formalistic, like Hilbert and Alan Weir, and various other partway houses in between, for instance, Neo-Freudianism as practiced at least at one time in Scotland by Bob Hale and Crispin Wright and various others. So the question of Platonism and anti-Platonism is still a live one in the philosophy of mathematics, and that's essentially a metaphysical question. And I'm mentioning it because I think it's not resolved. I have my own opinion on how to resolve it, but I don't think it's resolved on a communal basis. In biology, maybe there is a little more resolution because biology is an empirical science, but there have been lots of debates about the nature of evolution, whether it's a clearly scientific theory or not, whether you need to use the concept of emergence in order to explain certain features in life. The notion of emergence, which was presaged by John Stuart Mill, actually came about in the 19th century through a very good English philosopher called George Henry Lewis, better known as the partner of Mary Ann Evans or George Eliot. Lewis was an excellent philosopher in his own right and a very good historian of philosophy, and in his posthumously published book, Problems of Life and Mind, he came up with the notion of an emergent quality, something which has come to prominence again in the last 20 years, although it was also prominent in the early 20th century with people like Samuel Alexander. There is also the question of the nature of species. Are they individuals? Are they classes? Are they something else? And so on, which has bedeviled the philosophy of biology for a long, long time. So these are metaphysical questions. What is a species? Are there such things as species? Is it actually just a falsification and a fictionalization to talk about species in biology? Some people think it is, some people think it isn't, and so on. In psychology or the philosophy of mind, monism and dualism, again, a problem that's not gone away. You only need to go to a philosophy of mind conference and you've got a fight on your hands. Not necessarily between you and anybody else. If you keep quiet, you can just watch everyone else fighting. Then we have the question of whether reductionism works or whether emergence is applicable, what's the nature of qualia, and so on. Again, these are well-known problems which keep Blackwell's philosophy section full. And finally, and possibly slightly less fundamentally, but still hot topics in linguistics, whether language is innate in human beings or whether it's determined in its form by the way in which we're brought up and in what culture, whether there are universals of language or not. Those are all areas in which metaphysical questions interact intimately with scientific investigations at various levels of generality. And it is extremely difficult when you get down to the nitty-gritty details to say, well, this is philosophy or this is physics or this is philosophy or this is linguistics. The two blend into each other. So I think this is just a crossover or a transition that we should accept, and we say, look, this is a place where metaphysics comes into contact with empirical and or special questions. I'm going to talk about some applications which don't fit Blackwell's bookshelves, or at least haven't yet. And they're all drawn from my own experience, and this is, I don't want this to turn into a kind of autobiographical talk, but I'm drawing on things that I have worked on myself and that I've thought about. And I will say, and Anna mentioned this at the very beginning, that the reason why I got into this had absolutely or very little to do with me being a philosopher. What happened was that as a visiting professor in the University of California in Irvine in the late 80s, I was co-opted as a consultant onto a team of software engineers who were designing advanced database management systems in a small company called Ontech Corporation, and the name should give it away that this had to do with ontology. It was an abbreviation, if you like, of ontological technology. And they had various customers, including aerospace companies, aluminium corporations, engine companies, and latterly the United States Air Force. And I'll mention one or two things to do with that. Now, how did it come about that a philosopher was involved in talking to people who wrote programs in their sleep? The answer was that they wanted to do things in a way which they thought could get their software to work better on a wider range of problems and attack problems that had not been successfully attacked hitherto. We're talking the 1980s here. This is a long, long time ago in computer terms. Now, what happened was that what I thought would turn out to be just a few visits on Fridays for a single term, turned into a 12-year relationship where I would go back to California two or sometimes three times a year for a week or two at a time and talk to them about software design. And this went on until the company collapsed. Now, why did the company collapse? That's a very interesting story. And I confess I may not be completely blameless in this, and we'll talk about this. I'll talk about this towards the end. I might have done more to stop it from collapsing, but I probably think I couldn't have done. But anyway, I'll tell you about why it collapsed in a little while. But because of the nature of the work, first of all, it didn't involve publication. So I have discs and discs of things which have never been published, which were developed in order to help the company design its software. That was one thing. So I was working like hell, but not actually publishing it. Secondly, I was getting reasonably well paid, certainly very well paid by academic standards, for going and hanging out on the Southern California coast and drinking red wine and swimming in swimming pools after a 12-hour day working on design problems. I'm getting sworn at for my pains because software engineers are not the mildest mouthed creatures on the planet. But the most important thing was we were a team that was trying to actually produce an implementable general metaphysics. That was the point of what we were trying to do, hence the name Ontech. And it had been formed before I got there, but I was the one who brought, if you like, the professional ontological input to the enterprise. And that's probably where it started going wrong. I'll come back to that. The lessons that I drew from that and some of the things that we had to do in order to make the thing stop crashing, and it did crash many times over until the final crash, involved me in rethinking the basis of metaphysics, which is why my general attitude to metaphysics is not one which I acquired initially from reading books or writing papers in a philosophy setting. They are attitudes that I acquired by actually going out into the field consisting of an office in a small office suite in Southern California, and trying to help people to write programs which would do things to help people save money making airplanes, things like that. So we were applying ontology to database design, and quite expressly and deliberately so. And this was in order that we could help people to make airplanes more cheaply and more efficiently. And latterly, when the business and the world changed, to help them design the enterprises that made airplanes more efficiently, so that the enterprises would be more efficient at making airplanes more efficiently. So we actually slalomed or segued from manufacturing engineering design, software design for manufacturing engineering, to software design for enterprise engineering, building enterprises or modifying enterprises which would do this in the best way. As a result, now that, as I say, that enterprise basically folded in 2001. From a commercial point of view, it carried on for a few years as an academic enterprise, but basically ceased to exist when the president of the company had a heart attack and died at the age of 52. So my advice to those about to get into enterprise engineering and so on, don't. It's too stressful. But some of the things that I took from that, I went away and applied to other areas, which we might have chatted about during our design sessions, such as how to apply the concepts of ontology to the classification of physical features in physical geography, or how to distinguish between different kinds of media, something which was not particularly relevant in the pre-Facebook age, but now is much more relevant. And just picking up on something that I was personally interested in, what's the ontology of music look like? So these were various ways in which the applications of ontology to different areas got me thinking. And this had a two-way effect. One was that some of my views on ontology and metaphysics were changed by the exercise, and the other was that my views changed the exercise, they changed the way in which the company worked. So I'm going to go through these areas very briefly, just to say what the salient things that metaphysics can do for them in that area have been and are from my point of view. Okay, and I'm literally, except towards the end, I'm just going to talk about how I got involved in this and what I was doing. So database design was we were building a system called PATSIS, Platform for the Automated Construction of Intelligent Systems. Why it was called that is a long story, but the irony, of course, is that this was funded by the United States defense industry, but the acronym was derived from the notion of peace. And as I say, I worked on this in California for 12 years, on and off, mainly on. And this led to a series of papers, some of which I was either wholly responsible for, most of which, however, I was partly responsible for, with software designers, biologists, database engineers, and various others. And I've just listed the ones there which have to do with manufacturing engineering. And the reason they got me over to California was I'd written a book on mereology in the late 80s, which they were, I didn't know this, they were applying to their database designs in the late 1980s. And they said, well, Simons is over in California, so let's get him over and see what he has to say. And it turned out, now obviously an aeroplane has lots of parts. In fact, it has hundreds of thousands of parts. But you might think that there is nothing of great philosophical significance in that. And it turns out you'd be wrong, because actually there is both philosophical significance and engineering significance in the way in which complex artifacts like aircraft are designed, built, put together, maintained, and retired. And one of the things that drives costs in the aerospace industry is that this is a very, very, or has been, a very ad hoc and not particularly well-designed process. Certainly it wasn't when we got involved in the 90s. And so the first thing that needed to be done was to look at the discrepancies that arise in the different stages of design and manufacture as regards mereology, and see how they could be overcome, by what conceptual tools we could assist people to write software which would help them to manage manufacturing aeroplanes in a more efficient way. And we did it. We solved the problem from a theoretical point of view in the first paper. And the person who co-authored the paper with me was Chuck Dement, who was the president of Ontech Corporation, the guy who died at age 52. He, together with various other people — I wasn't allowed to do it because I was not a US citizen — co-authored a report for the United States Air Force on how this should be done. And the report is not coincidentally called MERIOS. It was a five-year technical — it was a bit like a research grant, but done again. So it goes for 5 years and employs a bunch of people, and at the end you get to write something. And in this case, there is a 100 and something page technical report which went to the US Air Force and was promptly ignored because they'd run out of money. But it does solve the problem of what you need to do in order to reconcile the different forms of engineering that go into complex manufacturing at a theoretical level, at a metaphysical level. We're not telling them, use this kind of screw instead of that kind of bolt. We're saying, how do you reconcile the discrepancies between different bills of materials? I then went on to apply some of those notions in analogy to the theory of tropes, looking at the way in which these came out both in engineering and in biology. I then became, when I moved to England, I then became involved with the engineers in Leeds, who were also interested in very general problems of design, manufacturing products, and the problems of product management, again, which were coming up in very general forms. So I co-authored papers with engineers in Leeds. In fact, I'm still involved with people in Leeds in discussing matters of design. And as a result of this, I then went to talk to the Royal Academy of Engineering in London about the notion of how you apply metaphysics to engineering problems, and how mereology not only gets applicable, because obviously it's applicable, but how — and this was the interesting lesson for me — how the applications come back and bite the metaphysician. So my attitude when I started doing this was, oh, well, it's very easy. Here's the axioms for mereology. Go off and apply them. And the first thing that everyone said was, we can't. It doesn't work like that. the concepts of Variology are inapplicable and useless to real life, which for somebody who's written 400 pages on Variology came as a bit of a downer. So, what do you have to do is you have to distinguish, differentiate, and specialise notions of pond. And, you know, having eaten humble pie on this, I then decided I would write out what I thought those things ought to be, and that came out in a volume edited by the Royal Academy of Engineering called Ontology Learns from Engineering. So one of my mottos, or one of my methodological models at the end of this is, this is not a one-way process. It's not that metaphysicians go out into the community and dictate how people should do things from a metaphysically pure and clean point of view. It's that they go out into the community, they get their hands a bit dirty, and they come back and they have to rewrite their theories. And I think this happens, I mean, it happens obviously in those empirical sciences which work in close collaboration with those metaphysicians who work in close collaboration with empirical science, say in linguistics or physics or biology. But it tends not to get all the way back up to formal ontology. Well, if anything's part of formal ontology, Mariology is. And if Mariology needs to be tweaked because of applications, then formal ontology needs to be tweaked too. Enterprise design, as I say, was something that the firm eventually segued into because they realised you couldn't do things the way we said unless you redesigned the enterprises that did them, because the way the enterprises were designed was inimical to the way that things were done. And one of the things that we did, and I did this with an engineering graduate from Leeds called Vasilis Agoridas, was to look at how you implement change, both in an engineering sense and in an enterprise engineering sense. And as anyone who has ever tried to change an institution will tell you, getting change through is not easy. Indeed, seeing what to change is not easy either. But I was also led to reflect on the nature of the institutions and social wholes which are changed by changing. And that led to an invitation to a conference in Germany from which a German language paper resulted. One of the big changes I made to the company was to drag them away from essentialistic, logic-based analysis of data into a much more flexible and fluid way of analysing data, inspired by the methods of evolutionary biology. Basically, what happened was I read The History of Biology by Ernst Mayr and got on the phone and said, "I'm sorry, guys, this is all going to have to be rewritten." Because of the nature of species and the nature of evolution and all the different concepts you need to deal with classes of things in a non-essentialistic way, we're going to have to be dealt with. And that, combined with my own possibly futile adherence to nominalism, led me to look at various biological concepts from an ontological but also from a nominalistic point of view. And two at least of those papers were written in collaboration with a Chinese biologist called Yu Lin, although she's got a different name now because she's converted to Islam, but I can't remember what her name is. So I still call her Yu. One was just a Tarskian analysis of DNA sequences, for example. And then there were various other things that took my fancy. One was physical geography. Another was the emergence of new media, which I think is actually false. There aren't new media. There are just old media with new ways of being pushed around. The notions of a work of music, which had occupied me in my pre-Californian days, but which still occasionally occupies me and worries about the nature of aspects of music, for instance, the notion of rhythm, which Andy Hamilton's been working on in Durham. And various other minor applications. What's the notion of a face? Is it a boundary, or is it a thin layer of things? So those are various areas where I've gone out and done stuff where I thought that metaphysical concepts had application in various sciences. And there are probably one or two more that I'll eventually get into, but those are the ones that have kept me going recently. And one reason I like to do them is, well, not many other people are doing them. You know, you can you can trip over piles of philosophy of physics books this high, and they come out this year, but the philosophy of music books are rather rarer, and philosophy of physical geography books are extremely rare. In fact, I don't think there are any. So partly it's just me being pervertedly different from other people, which I've always liked being. Now, I've been talking about the application of ontology, a particular ontology or a series of developing ontologies, to empirical questions, to applications in the special sciences, the ultimate aim being to tidy these up and make them tractable in a way which they don't necessarily get to be when they're coming at you from below. So very often what happens is that scientists in various areas develop theories in order to deal with particular problems, descriptive or theoretical or calculatory, and they're a bit of a mess, metaphysically and philosophically speaking. And it often takes a little bit of a while to sort out the mess, sometimes decades, sometimes hundreds of years, who knows. But the job of, there is a role for an ontologist in this, which is to make use of the fact that they're happy dealing in abstractions, that they are used to theories being controversial and insecure, and that they are not necessarily going to take everything that the scientist says as 100% true, but they're going to be prepared to say, well, wouldn't you like to change things in this or that way? Now, that's ontology as the philosophers understand it. Now, there is another name, or there is another area, which is now called ontology, or better, ontologies, which is actually much more prevalent and which fills more books than the philosophical discipline. And this is the use of the term ontology in connection with databases and with information systems. An ontology, in this sense, is a representation which is meant to be implementation independent, or largely implementation independent or invariant. So in the old days, if you had two computers, such as a PC and a Macintosh, they wouldn't be able to talk to each other because they were using different codes, they were using different ways of encoding information. And that has its downside. The downside is that somebody has to do the translation from one to another. Now, this is a problem that crops up in spades with database systems. Database systems have been going since the first large mainframes in the 1960s, since IBM put together computers which were too big to fit in this room and got them to run companies like Alcoa or Westinghouse. And in those days, because computers were slow and expensive, people were extremely fussy about how they did low-level detail, how they wrote data to disk, how they read data from disk, and things like this. What happened as Moore's Law kicked in and chips got quicker and quicker, processing got quicker and quicker, was that programmers didn't need to be so fussy anymore. They could do things in a more sloppy way. They didn't have to be pernickety about low-level detail. But they were also getting into areas where they wanted to represent large amounts of data in a way which was accessible to large numbers of human beings, not just to the programmer who wrote the code or the two or three people who were able to interact with it. This, as computers became more and more widely applicable, applied and needed to interact with more and more people, the need for systems which were not specific to a particular operating system or manufacturer became more apparent. And this has given rise to requirements for ontologies. Ontologies are representation systems which are supposed to be A, humanly understandable, so they aren't, you know, C++ code or something even more low-level than that. But B, structure the data that they are dealing with in a way which is translatable between different operating systems. So that's basically what ontologies are meant to do. And they have been on the way for about 20 years. So from the mid-90s onwards, people have been coming up with different kinds of ontologies. Now, in the first instance, the ontologies were designed by computer scientists. And so they were fantastic for writing code, and they were more or less impossible for users to understand. And they also were philosophically horrendous in various different ways. So what we were doing in California in the 90s was in part trying to make up for the fact that the ontologies that people were coming up with were not very helpful, were not very useful. And three kinds of approach developed in the 1990s, which I've listed here. They aren't the only ones that are out there. There are lots and lots and lots of ontologies. You go into the computer science or database section of Blackwell's, and I'm sure there will be shelves and shelves of books of ontologies, but I'm just going to mention the three that I'm most familiar with for various reasons. The first is one called Psyche. Psyche is an abbreviation of, or it takes three words out of the middle of the word, encyclopedia. And it was designed by an American computer scientist called Doug Lennart, who had the idea in the early 90s that artificial intelligence should build a computer that's as bright as a human being. And the idea that Lennart has was you get an axiom system into which you write common sense. So basically what Psycor, which is based in Austin, Texas, does is it employs philosophy and computer science and maths graduates to write axioms for things like traffic law, or how to make a chair, or how to get rid of woodworm from your garden shed, and things like that. So what it's trying to do is it's trying to axiomatize common sense knowledge and produce a machine which is so bright that it will compete with and even outshine human beings. The idea is eventually the machine will wake up and say, cogito ergo sum. Okay, that's Governance's way of doing things. You throw huge amounts of information through an axiom system at a computer, and eventually the computer will be as bright as a human being. It will have encyclopedic knowledge. Now, one of the problems with that, apart from the fact that it is a big enterprise and lots of people are involved in writing different axioms, is that you've got to channel it through a categorical system. You've got to make the different parts of the knowledge all fit together. So you're faced with the metaphysical problem of how to fit this all together. And if you look at the site, this is publicly available, if you look at Psyche's so-called high-level ontology, what you'll find is that it is a complete pig's ear from a philosophical point of view. It's better than the things that computer scientists were doing in the 80s, but it's still philosophically dreadful. And therefore, I predict it will not work. And in fact, the evidence seems to be that Psyche is a little bit of a backwater these days. The second way of dealing with things is the one I was involved in, which was the Patches system in ONTEC. And our idea was, and it wasn't my idea initially, it was the idea of the president, and I was being paid, so I did what I was told, was what we need is a revisionary metaphysics which will deal with everything in a way which doesn't necessarily correspond with either A, ordinary language and thought, or B, the way in which computer scientists have done things in the past. So this was a system which was inspired by a diverse range of philosophical and IT models, but from a philosophical point of view, they included, among others, Carnap, Whitehead, once, but also Husserl. So it was a phenomenological ontology, at least in part. And then latterly, as I say, by my biology, according to the views that I helped them to come along to. The problem with Patsis was, there were two problems. One was an economic problem, and the other was a conceptual problem. And I've come to realise this now that there is sufficient distance between myself and the enterprise, namely, of more than 10 years. The economic problem was something we probably had no control over, which was the demise of mainframe computers. Patsis was written to be implemented on one-off mainframe computers running huge companies like Lockheed Martin or Alcoa. And those were our customers in the early days. But the advent of the personal computer, of networking, and of off-the-shelf Microsoft-style software basically meant that mainframe computers have disappeared for all but a few highly computatively intensive tasks for which you use supercomputers. So, for instance, like analysing the results from CERN, which just requires a lot of crunching of data, but doesn't require a lot of understanding. So, in a sense, the project took too long. It should have been up and running in the 90s, but because of the conceptual difficulties that it ran into in the mid-90s, effectively, the world had moved on. It had moved on to desktop PCs, networks together. And, you know, one can take an attitude to that was, well, it's a shame it didn't go the way we wanted, or bully for us, that means everyone has a computer at home and in their pocket instead of having to go to a large machine in a special hall. So that was one change, and we noticed that coming towards the end of the 90s, fairly slowly, I think. The conceptual problem, which I think was a difficulty, and it certainly caused problems when we went out into the community and talked to the users, was that because it was effectively an idiosyncratic and revisionary metaphysics, it didn't take the trouble to meet people halfway. What happened was, in order to get the thing to work, it became so esoteric that the jargon became incomprehensible to users. It became incomprehensible to me, and I was one of the people who was helping to make it, to design it. So basically, at any one time, at most one person would understand what was going on, and that was Chuck. And the rest of us would chip in with bits here and there and sort of catch on to his coattails from time to time. So there is a lesson there. I mean, it's a lesson for the application of metaphysics, not a lesson for metaphysics. The lesson is, if you're too revisionary, you will not be understood. Now, again, you can just say, well, look, I'm a metaphysician, I'm a pure philosopher. I don't care if people around me don't understand. Just give them 1,000 years and maybe they'll come round. You know, I mean, you know, Whitehead is not understood by very many people, but maybe in 100 years' time, people would be saying, how could we have been so thick not to understand Whitehead? Or how could we have been so thick not to understand Alexander? Or some other person who's, you know, fairly low on the spectrum of general respect in philosophy. I noticed in Blackwell's that just above the two rows of secondary literature on Wittgenstein, there was one book of secondary literature on Whitehead and no primary text I could find. And the one book was by a Deleuzian. And I don't think that's going to help Whitehead. Anyway, that's another story. So, as a business user in Leeds once said, this is a great idea, but you'll have to cut out the Serbo-Croat, which I think is very unfair to Serbo-Croats because they actually speak a natural language, whereas we weren't doing that. One of the symptoms of this was that the Oxford English Dictionary didn't have enough words for what we wanted in certain areas. So we're having to make up new words. Now the third approach is the one which, at least from a user point of view, seems to be the most fruitful. And in fact, I would go further and say, is proving to be the most fruitful. And that's the approach I call BFO. Now BFO stands for Basic Formal Ontology. And it's no accident that it uses the word formal. This is a suite of concepts designed and put together to inform the kernel, the formal kernel or framework of any ontology you want to use, whatever you want to apply it to. You might want to apply it to genome sequencing. You might want to apply it to diseases of the liver. You might want to apply it to criminal investigations. You might want to apply it to battlefield scenarios in World War III. If you want to do that, you can. And in fact, all of those implementations have been created using basic formal ontology. Now, the principal architect of basic formal ontology is Barry Smith of Buffalo. And so he's the ontological Barry Smith, not the enological Barry Smith, the one who writes about the philosophy of wine, which I'm sure is much more pleasant but less far-reaching discipline. Barry Smith and his collaborators at ENCOR, the National Center for Ontological Research in the USA, have produced a basic formal ontology, starting in Germany, later moving to the USA, which has a small suite of concepts which are formal. They don't go into the implementation, they stay the same, but which allow you to add on material or regional stuff structured by those formal concepts. So it performs the Husserlian task of not getting involved directly in implementation, so it doesn't need to keep tweaking itself every time something new comes up, which is what Psyche did and what Patsis did. But also, it is powerful enough to enable you to build ontologies which help to tidy up big databases. For instance, the genome database, or the database of cancer research in the American Cancer Institute. These have all had databases built using BFO to help deal with big data. If you want to see the dozens, if not hundreds, of formal ontologies which have been built using BFO in the last few years, just go to the ontology website at Buffalo. What that shows is, firstly, in order to be of use to the community you're reaching out to, you have to talk their language. Psyche tried to do that without doing the formal work. Patsis tried to do the formal work without speaking the lingo of the person in the street or in the shop floor. Barry Smith has managed to do a very nice, what should we say, compromise between those two situations. For instance, he is a metaphysical dualist. He thinks that there are occurrence and continuance, and that they're both equally basic. So he has a continuum part relation and an occurrent part relation. Speaking as a formal mereologist, I think that's completely wrong. But, nevertheless, it works, because that's the way we speak. So basically what's going on in BFO is, it is a computerized implementation of Husserl's idea for descriptive metaphysics, whereas what we were trying to do in California was the same, but for revisionary metaphysics. And the trouble with being revisionary is people go, when you talk to them, as they have done for Whitehead for the last 80 years, and as people did to us. So what models do I draw from this for method in metaphysics? Well, firstly, and something I haven't talked about, is you cannot do metaphysics without having one or two unsubstantiated hunches that you are working within. I call them grandly speculative hypotheses or framework assumptions. My own particular framework assumptions are, I'm a naturalist, I'm an atheist, I'm a nominalist. So I don't believe in mathematical objects, I don't believe in God, I don't believe in abstract objects, and so on. All of which makes my life very difficult, because lots of people out there do, so I have to do kind of mental translation to try and figure out what they're talking about. But that's, you know, to a certain extent, that's my problem. Other people have different points of view. So, for instance, Whitehead was not a naturalist because he believed in eternal or abstract objects. He wasn't a dualist, but he was a panpsychist. He thought that electrons had feelings. And so does Galen Strawson, and so does one or two other intelligent people. There are metaphysical speculative assumptions that you make when you're doing metaphysics. The next thing to do is what to do about the fact that we have undone the linguistic term. And the answer is, that is a very difficult question. How to actually do metaphysics post the undoing of the linguistic term is something that one or two people have thought about. The late Jonathan Lowe, for instance, thought a lot about it. And I thought about it, and one or two other people have thought about it. But the answer is, there's no free lunch. You can't do things on the cheap. It's very hard. Metaphysics is hard. Jonathan used to say that all the time, and I absolutely agree with him. And one reason why it's hard is that you don't just drag your metaphysics off the semantics of predicate logic or set theory or whatever your favourite formal thingy is. You have to do it another way. And it's a complicated way, and I'm not going to talk about it. But here is the payoff for being a metaphysician who's prepared to go out into the community. First of all, you have a way to test your theories. You know, metaphysics is not something that is so abstract you can't test it. If, for example, you say, I'm an anonymous, I don't think you can have qualia without there being physical goings-on in the brain, and some spark at MIT comes up with an experiment which proves that you can, then you have to say, shoot, I guess I'd better be a dualist after all, or I'd better be something else rather than a reductionist moment. So there is the possibility, it's a remoter possibility than for empirical science, but there is the possibility for metaphysics to put forward propositions which are refuted by the facts. So it's an empirical discipline, it's just not very empirical. Secondly, and this is what I've learned a lot, applications can cause you to revise your general metaphysics. It happened with me in the case of neurology. It also happened because I happened to have a bit of a training in library science, because before I became a philosopher I was a librarian, and for my pains I learned about faceted classification systems invented in the 1930s by Sri Ranganathan, the greatest library scientist of all time, librarian at the University of Madras. And he came up with a classification system which is the basis of all good classification systems now. It's called faceted classification. And it turns out that that is exactly analogous to the way in which the best evolutionary biologists, the cladists, classify organisms into clades, or descendants of a common ancestor, using what they call characters. So what facets are for library scientists, characters are for biologists. And when you apply that to metaphysics, you get what I call factors, but they're still the same thing. They're basically common properties. There's nothing really esoteric about them. But it turns out that doing it that way and being very, very specific about it gives you flexibility and the ability to make your theories reach parts that other theories don't reach in a similar way. So learning about the differences and similarities between clasistic biology and library science means that you can apply the results of that to such things as the philosophical theory of categories. I've already talked about descriptive versus revision in metaphysics. I'm an unabashed revisionist, but I also think we need to explain how it is we have the concept systems we do in descriptive metaphysics. How rationalistic should you be? Very, very difficult question. How fallibilistic should you be? Answer, totally. You should be fallibilistic about as much as you can possibly be. Maybe not the law of contradiction, but not much else, I think, will survive. One and one is still two, but there is a story about that. How should you approach the ontology that your views and theories commit you to? Answer, not the way Quine did it. That's something that I've been working on with Barry and various other people in the theory of truth-making for 30-odd years now, when I think about it. So, I'll just conclude with two other uplifting morals. Another one from Whitehead, which is about fallibilism, and especially in philosophy. In philosophical discussion, the merest hint of dogmatic certainty as to finality of statement is an exhibition of folly. Love that. And the other is my favourite quote from Brentano, and it's in Latin, vera philosophiae methodus nulla alia nisi scientiae naturalis est. The true method of philosophy is no other than that of the natural sciences. Thank you.